To hunt a species to extinction is not logical.
Whoever said the human race was logical?
Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where this week we are continuing our exploration of Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Roca. I'm a writer, producer, host in San Diego, California, and excited to be back in the 23rd century, about to head off into the 20th century with these two gentlemen.
And we, of course, would never venture time travel without the assistance of our Star Trek expert, the great, great Scott Mance. Welcome back to The Cinephiles.
Fellas, it is so great to be back here on The Cinephiles with my two favorite movie friends, talking about my absolute favorite thing in the world, which, of course, is Star Trek. We had such a great conversation about The Voyage Home in part one of The Cinephiles on Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home. And we are literally just getting started.
And, of course, just as the crew of the Enterprise has always needed the support of Starfleet Command, we need the support of our good, good friends at patreon.com/thecinephiles, as well as Apple Podcasts. There literally is no Cinephiles without you. So thank you, all of you, for your incredible support of this show.
Yeah, another way you can support us is if you hear during these commercial breaks some of the products that from the clients that sponsor us here on the show, and you want to try them out, then using our code to get massive discounts on those products and to signal to these clients who sponsor us that they should keep sponsoring us here on The Cinephiles, that's another way you can help us and also help yourself. So please look, listen to that and help us out here on The Cinephiles. Thank you, guys.
And where we left off, the crew of the Enterprise had determined that the fate of the humanity rested on going back in time to rescue two humpback whales and bring them back to the 23rd century. And that's what we're doing right now, as the Bounty is flying off fast towards the sun.
What's our target in time?
Late 20th century.
Can you be more specific?
Not with this equipment. I've had to program some of the variables from memory.
What are some of the variables?
And then Spock, in Spock fashion, lists all the variables he had to keep in memory and do math with.
Prompting, of course, the perfect reply, response from Dr. McCoy.
Angels and ministers of grace, defend us.
Hamlet, Act 1, Scene 4.
Once again, Star Trek quoting Shakespeare, Spock knowing where this line came from, Hamlet, Act 1, Scene 4.
And I think that makes them feel a little bit better that maybe his memory is working, you know?
Yeah.
The one thing I like all the differences on the Klingon bird of prey as they accelerate. There's not nearly as much shaking and rattling on the old Enterprise as there is in this ship. And I think that makes that a lot of fun.
Before we jump in, do you think they could have pulled this off in the Enterprise? Is there something, because I mean, Enterprise would have had a cloaking device, right? So would they have come up with this idea if they weren't in a Klingon ship? Because, I mean, where would they have been able to hide the Enterprise, a massive ship like that, on Earth and not be seen yet still be close to these whales? It seems to almost be a bit of luck and, of course, screenwriting luck that they're flying back in a Klingon ship with the cloaking device.
Great question. That's a great question, Johnny. My intuition feels like, yes, of course, the Enterprise would have been able to do it. The Enterprise already did it twice. Right. Once by accident in Tomorrow's Yesterday, and then deliberately they did it in Assignment Earth to observe the happenings in Earth's then tumultuous year in its history, 1968. But would they have been able to sort of hide themselves from the monitors of the 20th century? And I feel like even though they didn't have a cloaking device, they did have their deflector screens.
Good call.
I'm willing to bet would have been a way for them to hide themselves from the sensors of the time.
Right on.
I think Kirk would have found a way.
but
it certainly is lucky that we have. What I think is great, there's just this great thing that happens when you're writing sometimes where you realize that you set up the thing. They didn't know they were going to go back in time and have to hide the Bounty in the middle of Golden Gate Park. But the moment, I'm sure, where they went, oh, we have a cloaking device.
Right.
They went, oh, everything is coming together. I also think, by the way, this approach to the sun, as we're accelerating and we can hear Sulu counting off the warp speed and the speed of everything and the shaking and the explosion that happens and all. I think it's pretty thrilling in terms of getting back in time.
It really is, because as Sulu is counting off warp 9.2, 9.3, the bounty is shaking more and more. And as it gets to, like, I think 9.7 or 9.8, the monitor screen by Uhura explodes. You know, what's interesting about the way the scene is shot, where you see the bounty, like, kind of pull away from the sun. When you go back and watch the remastered version of Tomorrow's Yesterday with the new visual effects that they did back in 2007, the shots look very similar of the bounty and the Enterprise, you know, the TOS Enterprise pulling away from the sun. Just an observation.
And then we come around the sun going super, super fast, and then things get real weird.
This is 1980s weird, yeah.
I mean, we got Kirk's head morphing into other heads, and we have like things falling, and it is full on. I think we did too much LDS in Berkeley. What seems to be going on here?
You're hearing lines from the rest of the film, because you hear Scotty say, "There be wheels here." And you hear Kirk say, "Haven't you gotten any goddamn feelings about that?" I mean, you don't know that you're hearing lines from later on in the film. You don't know where these lines are coming from. I wonder what the storyboard must have looked like for that, or what the conversations Nimoy had with visual effects, because that looks a lot of CGI is going on there.
Remember you guys when we did Star Trek the Motion Picture, there was this feeling of like they wanted to compete with 2001, right? And I wonder if some of those ideas are here in this time travel sequence, because it's kind of similar to what happens in 2001. I mean, obviously not as artistic or a jaw-dropping, but there are elements of it that feel like 1970 sci-fi approach to time travel, even though this is a mid-80s film. And especially seeing that weird body, like just floating through this blue flame and then landing in the water. Like, what is all of that? And so
the image of the, they're starting to come to, you see like the water, the pond.
Yeah, with the reeds.
With the leaves and everything emanating from the water. And you don't see the bounty, but you hear it fly overhead.
Right.
And then the water ripples for a little bit, and then it calms down, and then it's like slowly dissolves back into the bridge of the bounty with everybody kind of passed out. I think it's a beautiful sequence.
Yeah.
It is definitely goes into the realm of we're going to try something here, you know, like it's not a linear thought. It's like, we're going for something. And I just want to go, I have no evidence of what I'm going to say at all, but I want to tell a story that I knew someday we would get to this movie and I could tell this story because it has its origin in an earlier episode of The Cinephiles, which is that two of my favorite episodes, and I think, John, you'll agree, is when we did Back to the Future with Mike Vogel and Shannon McClung as our guests.
Sure.
And there was some time where they were in discussions with ILM, and ILM was trying to figure out what time travel looked like.
Right.
And they came up with this whole conceptualization that involved the latest technology and was very exciting. And I know that they presented it to Zemeckis, and it was going to be expensive, but this was going to look very cool. And Zemeckis said, "Oh, but time travel is instantaneous. Like, but there's no, we don't see anything. Right. There is no time passing. That's how we're not going to shoot anything for time travel." And I remember when we discussed this, that ILM was a little dissatisfied that all of their work into this conceptual idea of time travel had to go away.
Wow.
And a couple of years later, we have this. So,
interesting. Okay.
Well, you know what? It makes sense that of all the time travel scenes we've seen depicted in TV and film over the years, that Zemeckis makes the most sense. You know, when you're with Marty McFly inside the time machine, the DeLorean, and he hits 88 miles per hour, and then
he's gone.
Then he's like, it's 1955. He hits the Scarecrow, and smashes into the barn and, you know, old man Peabody comes out and shoots one of his pine trees and the rest is history.
But we have gone through our crazy time travel. And I just want to point out that, you know, it's little things. I know you guys will both appreciate this, that you keep consistent when you go from the TV show to the movies, is that whenever the whole crew gets knocked out, Kirk always wakes up first.
Yeah, of course. He's the captain.
Or he's the last to pass out. Like, remember,
or the last to pass out. Why not both?
I take full responsibility.
So he wakes up. He wakes Sulu up. And I like that it's sort of the, it's like you're wake, everyone's kind of passed out on the couch of they waking up after the crazy party they had the night before. That's how it feels to me. Yeah.
Earth, but when? Spock.
Judging by the pollution content of the atmosphere, I believe we have arrived at the latter half of the 20th century.
Now, what does that remind you of? Did that ring a bell to something we might have heard, something similar back in the original series?
Oh, I'm assuming maybe in Bread and Circuses?
Oh, good. You're good, you. You are good.
Is that it?
Yes, sir. That's what I'm referring to.
I was a little scared on that one.
God almighty, Steve. I tell you, yes. Yes, in Bread and Circuses, when they beam down to the planet of the Romans and, you know, you hear Spock looking at his tricorder, he says about the pollution content of the air, and McCoy goes, the word was smog.
I think this is the beginning of a thing this movie does that's hard to describe, but it's like taking advantage of our love-hate relationship with our present time. You know what I mean? Because there's this moment where it's like, oh, yep, judging from the pollution content, late 20th century, there's this kind of thing like, yeah, man, that's my century. You're coming to see me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There are quite a few shots taken at the current, current timeline, yeah.
And as we fly towards Earth, we hear,
Admiral, I am receiving whale song.
Put them on speakers.
And then we hear the actual whales. And it's kind of moving, I think.
Yeah, because now you're not listening to an adjusted version of the whale song that Uhura put together when they were trying to figure out exactly what this was. Now you're hearing the actual whale song. And, you know, there's no score, no incidental music going along with it. It's just them listening to that going like, this is what we came here for.
Admiral, this is strange. The song is directly ahead. It's coming from San Francisco.
From the city?
I want to say something totally dumb. Okay. Which is that, I mean, we've all done this, you know, I'm sure, Scott, when you've seen stuff from Philadelphia, you know, movies from Philadelphia that you have special relationships to it, or John, if it's from Northern Virginia or other places you've lived, this is a very small thing that makes this such a San Francisco movie to me, which is they said, from the city. And I know people don't know this, but if you hear someone say, oh, I'm going to go to San Fran, or I'm going to go to SF, or I'm going to go to Frisco, none of those people are from San Francisco. Right. Nobody in San Francisco says that. If I say I'm going to go to San Francisco, I say I'm going to the city. The city is the name of San Francisco to people who live in the Bay Area.
How interesting.
That is such an interesting observation. Such an interesting observation. Yeah, I do know that people from San Francisco hate when other people call it all of those things that you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is, you know, from Philadelphia, even people from Philadelphia refer to it as Philly.
Yeah.
You know, like they don't like, yeah, I'm from Philly. I always say that. I never even say the whole city's name. I'm from Philly.
Right. Yeah. Right. But I can't say to someone who doesn't know me, it's like, where are you from? I'm from the city. That doesn't make any sense at all. It only makes sense if I'm in the Bay Area at the time.
Yeah.
You know?
That doesn't make sense.
Admiral, we have a serious problem. Would you please come down?
And what we find out from Scotty is, of course, the dilithium crystals are decrystallizing.
What's happening here that they always did so, so well in the original series. We already had the stakes high. We had to find whales, convert the cargo bays into a water tank to hold the whales, and then go back to the future. But now it has turned into a race against time because we have to do this before the crystals are deteriorating. And we have no way yet, anyway, of how to do that with this more primitive technology in the century that we are now in.
Yeah.
And yet that primitive technology might be the solution we need, because Spock realizes that there was this flirtation with nuclear fission reactors in the 20th century, which is so funny because at this time, in terms of the environmental way of looking at the world, the idea that we were using nuclear power was crazy. And all of lefty people like me were out protesting against nuclear power. I'm kind of pro-nuclear power at this point in life. You know, things have changed. Wow. And what I think about it, but that's a conversation for another day. But it's just where we are.
Where would we find these reactors, theoretically?
Nuclear power was widely used in naval vessels.
I think this is one of the most beautiful long-term setups for a joke ever. It's still what they're setting up.
It's a great long-term setup for a joke, but also for a moment that kind of hits you right in the heart for a minute there, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll get to that moment soon.
We're flying into the city and Sulu says,
San Francisco. I was born there.
I love that. I love getting that backstory.
I have to believe that he made sure that was in the movie. I don't know if the writers put it in already to give Sulu a little showcase, but we know George Takei has been real clear, real open about his protection and his love of the Asian community and what happened to his parents and his family in the Japanese and German camps. So San Francisco is well known, you know, to be a city that supports a very strong Asian community. So I would imagine that was an important thing to say at the time. You know?
That's a great point. I wonder if that came from George or if that came from the writers.
Yeah, it's like a signaling to his community, right? Because Nichelle Nichols makes it very clear in numerous interviews how Martin Luther King talked her into going back to Star Trek after she was considering leaving.
Correct.
Because what she represented to Black culture, to Black people, right? And I wonder if this was George Takei's, who's no wallflower, signaling to his own community, like, I'm going to represent us or give a little shout outs, like the Carol Burnett ear tug kind of to his community.
Yep. I wonder. Wow. Good one.
It's really interesting to think about how important the characters of Sulu and Uhura are, considering how little they were given to do through much of the original series. You know, like just these tiny little that we held on to. And now when we get to Star Trek 3 and Star Trek 4, where they're going to have just giving them a moment means so much, you know?
Yeah, it sure does.
Kirk spins around. I just like the framing of the shot that he's sitting in the captain's chair, but he spins around so we can see the view screen in the background, and he gives everyone his orders in that. Uhura and Chekov are going to go find some nuclear vessels. McCoy, Scotty, and Sulu are going to figure out how to convert the whale tank, and Kirk and Spock are going to find the whales.
I want you all to be very careful. This is Terra Incognita. Many of their customs will doubtless take us by surprise. It's a foregone conclusion. None of these people have ever seen an extraterrestrial before.
And Spock reaches into his robe and in a total, John, I'm sure you'll agree, actorly way, mimes that he's tearing some fabric out when he clearly is not, you know.
But John, you brought up something in the part one of this conversation about Nimoy's performance.
Oh, yeah.
How there are some of his best moments in this movie are without any dialogue. And I think this is one of them, because without saying a word, you know, he tears off part of his robe to make a bandana to put around his eyebrows and his ears. But then the look that he gives the crew, and then the look that he gives McCoy and then Kirk, like, it's like problem solved. And there's humor to it, and you chuckle at it, but it's all without any dialogue.
Yeah, and it kind of also, if you're playing this, if you're watching his arc specifically, it's also, as an actor, you're giving the hint that pieces of your memory are coming back, and the comfortability of doing this kind of joking is what you do with people you're comfortable with. So he is slowly coming back to who he is. And a moment like this kind of showcases that. So, yeah, great point out, Scott.
And after some final inspiring words, we're commencing landing procedure. And then we cut to what I will call a classic supporting characters bit with a couple of guys in a dump truck. It's such an 80s scene.
You didn't see that. Neither did you.
You know, we've talked about in the movies we've talked about, and also in in the episodes of Star Trek, shift in tone. Shift in tone. One of my favorite movies of all time is the original Superman from 1978, directed by Richard Donner, because of the shift in tones between Krypton and Smallville and Metropolis. And the shift in tone from the moment Kirk says, let's do our job and get out of here, remember where we parked, to this moment now with the trash guys, the movie is already something different. It's a different thing. It is immediately a fish out of water. And we're going to see in a second, especially when they're in the city downtown. Yeah. I love how the shift in tone, it's like, okay, now we're going to have some fun.
That moment where the gangway comes out, like that light that from the cloak ship comes out and they appear, the dump truck drives away terrified. And as you said, Scott, the line of
everybody remember where we parked.
I think that's critical to the whole movie. You know what I mean? In terms, it was in the trailer and it sets the tone of like, oh, I get what this is going to be.
You know?
And we have that hard cut to the bustling city with the music hitting, and it looks great. It's super chaotic, super urban. They walk into the middle of the busy street, and a taxi almost hits them, and we hear,
hey, watch where you're going, you dumbass!
Well, a double dumbass on you!
One of the great lines, right? One of the great lines. You know, this moment when they shift from everybody remember where we parked, and then, you know, you hear the music cue and then the cut to that more contemporary urban setting in the score and certainly the setting itself in the city. This is the beginning of Act Two in the film. Just like we talked about how I think I was pointing out in part one, how, you know, there are three distinct points where it goes from Act One to Act Two to Act Three. We just crossed over into Act Two the moment we see our normally composed, confident crew in the 23rd century. Now they have no idea what the hell they are doing. They're truly fish out of water in the 20th century.
It's a miracle these people ever got out of the 20th century.
They're still using money. We got to find something.
And he gestures for the crew to stay there.
And the rest of you break up. It looked like a cadet review.
they're all like totally out of their element. And you know, I thought about it too when I was rewatching the film. So after Tomorrow Is Yesterday, and then City on the Edge of Forever, and then Assignment Earth, this is the last time you're going to see the original series crew in the 20th century. Mm.
Oh, great point.
I just think it is so fun. It's just, this is a gift to the fans. You know what I mean? Like, we've loved all these characters, and now we see them in this looking awkward and goofy in the middle of a San Francisco street. And there's just a feeling of, yes, I'm in for this. You know?
Yeah. They strip away all the rankings and from not having watched them for years, there's a level of respect and nobility that we kind of see these characters have, even though they have flaws and foibles and challenges and hurdles and are tempted by things throughout the series and the first few movies. But here in this moment, you strip away rankings. They're just bumbling around. And so it's almost like the first time you see your father or your mother, like, have a little human moment when you've seen them as this revered thing in your life. And it kind of changes things and makes them more human, more relatable. And I think this is a great moment because it's the way they're like, kind of bouncing into each other because they don't know which way to go after Kirk tells them to go and do whatever they need to do. I think it's a really funny moment. And it allows us to connect and care for them more because we're cheering them on even more so because they're fish out of water and we want them to succeed. So it's so smart.
So we cut to an antique store where a guy is perfect casting for an antique shop owner, comes downstairs with the glasses that were given to Kirk in Star Trek II. And we're trying to sell them.
I love Spock says,
excuse me, weren't those a birthday present from Dr. McCoy?
And they will be again. That's the beauty of it.
He's not wrong.
I mean, that joke is such a, like, again, it's a gift to fans. And I like, too, the comedy's always good with these guys.
I'll give you $100.
Is that a lot?
But the way Shatner can be so serious, very Kirk, very commanding, very, like warrior diplomat, and then the way that Shatner is able to just flick a switch and turn into a piece of the action, Trouble with Tribbles, I, Mud. That's where we're at now.
I mean, this is the remarkable thing about Star Trek to me, is that one doesn't outrule the other. Like, you could do, the fact that you can do I, Mud and do City on the Edge of Forever, and these are the same characters, and we accept it. The only show that I think has ever gotten it to this degree, to me, is Strange New Worlds. Like, Strange New Worlds can have a musical episode and an episode with animated characters showing up that are completely fun, and then they can have some really fucking heavy episodes.
Yep.
Absolutely. And the fact that they decided to make Strange New Worlds a throwback to the original series by making it, you know, episodic, you know, that really opened up the opportunity for them to take those big swings and those big tonal shifts from episode to episode, because you know, if it was like Discovery or Picard, where it's like one season is a story, they would not have been able to do that.
I mean, I get why people think these brands are so fragile and any variation will, you know, lead to disastrous results, because that's the social media world we live in, where people are constantly, and yet what Star Trek I hope shows is like, no, we actually, we can have a really dark Batman and we can have a fun Batman, and it's fine. Like, it's okay. We'll accept all of these if you do them well, you know?
Right.
So we split up the money, and now we've got Spock and Kirk, and we have the problem of how are we going to find some whales? And while Spock goes on a very, very logical explanation of the deductive reasoning he's going to use, Kirk sees a sign for two humpback whales on a bus.
I think we'll find what we're looking for at the Station Institute in Sausalito.
Hey, Cinephiles fans, this is John, and back with Steve here to talk about True Diagnostic. Now, Steve, you took this test a month ago, and it recommended some stuff for you to do. So where are you at in the process working with True Diagnostic?
Well, the cool thing about the test is that it gives you your biological age. How are you aging as compared to your actual age? My actual age is 56, and for the most part, I'm spot on aging at the same speed as my age. I'd rather age a little more slowly, but that's where we are. But the one area that concerned me was the biological age of my brain is both older and aging faster than the rest of me. My brain, according to this test, is 60 years old and aging faster, and that's a real cause for concern. Fortunately, True Diagnostic has recommendations.
Yeah. So what did they recommend? What are they saying for you to do in order to deal with this?
The nice thing is it gives specific recommendations based on my test results for choices I can make going forward, both in terms of diet, exercise, as well as supplements. And I'm trying to implement them. And in a couple of months, I do another test and we see how my aging has changed.
Oh man, I'm looking forward to that. I want to hear those results for sure. Well, if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to TrueDiagnostic.com and use our code Cinephiles to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use Cinefiles at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
A pair of humpback whales named George and Gracie.
How do you know this?
Simple logic.
And then they get on a bus, and they get off a bus, and we hear,
what does it mean, exact change?
These are all fun bits. Cut to, you know, Sulu, Bones, and Scotty walking through Chinatown, and they're trying to figure out how they're going to get the information they need to build this tank. And as they're trying to figure out how they're going to find the resources they need, they walk in front of a giant yellow wall that says, can't find it? Try Pacific Bell Yellow Pages. Let your fingers do the walking.
And walking out the door of that building is an Asian family.
Yeah.
Well, John, you asked a question a few minutes ago. Did George Takei have anything to do with Sulu being from San Francisco? Well, I think this might answer the question, because what was supposed to happen in this scene was that Sulu, our Sulu, was going to meet one of his great ancestors. And the child of the family that walked out the door in this scene. He was going to engage with them and discover that the kid was one of his ancestors.
Wow.
And the scene was written, and they were going to shoot the scene, but the young actor or you know, day player was not a professional actor. and they were having problems with him. He was nervous, and they couldn't get him to calm down. And the clock was ticking, and they had to move on.
Damn.
And they did not shoot the scene, and George Takei was heartbroken.
Oh, yeah, I bet. Damn. That's a bummer.
That's a drag.
Like you said, Steve, he only gets so much to do, him and Uhura and others. And so it's like, if you get a scene written for you, you want to make sure it gets in there. It's a shame. It's such a shame.
It really is. It would have been really nice to see.
Imagine. Poor guy. He didn't really get his great shakes, Sulu, until Star Trek VI when he got the Excelsior. Yeah. Finally. Yeah. And it's the last movie. But yeah, it's a shame. That would have been a great, great, great moment for Sulu and George Takei.
So this is a classic fish out of water movie. And the fun of a fish out of water movie is watching people try to navigate a world that we totally understand, but they don't understand.
Right.
And what occurred to me watching it this time, that was so funny. I was like, oh, I think people today, young people today in particular, they're closer to the 23rd century. If you sent them back to 1986 San Francisco and said, figure it out, like find your way around, they're like, well, I don't have a phone to tell me where to go.
Yeah, this is the perception. You're so correct, Steve. This is the perception. Technology has advanced so much, and we look at young people who can master stuff that we have trouble mastering. We go, my God, they're getting so smart. They're so quick to this stuff. It's just the tools that are available to them, right? Our parents felt the same when we were watching us mess around with VCRs or video game systems,
Atari.
Right?
Like, oh, hell.
But if you drop them back in the 1980s, some of them might not be able to navigate their world without that kind of assistance. So yes, they're smart enough to use that equipment, but they're not smart enough necessarily to be without that equipment. And so that's the thing that's very interesting when you look at the juxtaposition of that. So you make a great observation there, Steve.
So then we got to Uhura and Chekhov, who've also figured out to look in the yellow pages. And they're looking for nuclear vessels and government organizations. And this is, we have set this up. I think we started setting up this joke in 1967, whenever Chekhov's first episode was on Star Trek, because him walking up to a cop, and we feel it before it's happening. Like, you're like, oh no, he's going to ask him. And he says,
excuse me, sir. Can you direct me to the naval base in Alameda? It's where they keep the nuclear vessels.
And the cop is just looking at him. Just total straight face. So like great. A Russian in the 1986, Ronald Reagan's 1986, is asking a cop, can you tell me where the nuclear vessels are? Nuclear vessels. And no response. And by the way, to answer your question, there's a two-part answer to that, Steve. The first episode that we saw Chekhov in was A Mock Time, which was the second season premiere episode, which aired on September 15th, 1967. But the first time we saw Chekhov in production order was when he was on the bridge at Spock Station in Catspaw.
And I know that for Roddenberry, what is the ultimate example of the point of view, the philosophy of Star Trek is like, hey, we're going to have a Russian on the bridge.
Yep.
That's how far things have gone. And to me, that's now full circle, because we brought a Russian back to the Cold War asking for the nuclear vessels.
Yeah.
So all this is going on. They're asking passersby, like, where's the nuclear vessels and Alameda? And so that, these extras were supposed to walk by and not say anything. They were just supposed to maybe give a reaction, but keep going.
Oh.
Well, one of the extras actually said,
ooh, I don't know if I know the answer to that. I think it's across the bay in Alameda.
That's what I said, Alameda. I know
but
that.
But where is Alameda?
Which is funny. But what I didn't realize is that extra was not supposed to say anything.
Oh, wow.
But because she did give an answer, she wound up getting her SAG card.
Oh.
Because she now had a speaking part in a feature film. But Nimoy thought the scene was so funny, especially Walter Koenig's ad-libbed reaction. Yes, Alameda. Yes, that's what I said. I know that. that he kept it all in, and the scene was all the better for it.
Wow. Yeah.
We cut from there to another hilarious scene, guys. We're on a bus going over the Golden Gate Bridge. Kirk and Spock sitting there, and there is the the apotheosis of punk rockers, the perfect punk rocker listening to the perfect violent, horrible punk rock song, and the looks with the passengers who all want this guy to quiet down.
Excuse me. Would you mind stopping that noise?
And this punk rocker makes the mistake of flipping off Admiral Kirk.
Imagine, but you know what? Do you think Kirk knows what he just did? You think Kirk knows that expression?
That's a good question.
I'm guessing he doesn't. but the punk rocker is played by Kirk Thatcher. His name is actually Kirk, and he is the associate. He was the associate producer working on Star Trek IV, and he pitched Nimoy the scene and offered to write the song that goes with it.
Oh wow!
And wow. You know, because he was an associate producer, he had brought it up to Nimoy. He pitched it to Nimoy, but then as you know, things got going, production and filming, you know, he didn't bring it up again because you know he's just an associate producer. He doesn't want to be a pain in the ass to the director who happens to be Leonard Nimoy. But then Nimoy turned to him one day and said, "Hey, that idea, yeah, do it." So he wrote the song, and there it is. I hate you. And I love the part of the song where it's because I don't like you. And then you hear, and I say, screw you. That's so funny.
And what happens is Spock reaches over and we have the famous Spock neck pinch.
Love it. The FSMP.
And he falls right on the radio, which is perfect.
And everyone applauds.
You know why? Because generations may change, but those moments constantly live. Like somebody blasting their music as they're driving by in their car or in their apartment or all that kind of stuff. You see it all the time. It still happens. Or they're on the phone in a public place in like Panera having a really loud conversation instead of going outside or something. You see it all the time.
Yeah. Grumpy Steve Morris will tell you there is nothing that I find more irritating than the speakerphone talking to your phone on speakerphone in a restaurant.
Grumpy John Rooka agrees with you. Grumpy John Rooka agrees with you.
Oh, my God. You want to have a conversation? Please leave the restaurant. And there's these things called headphones. And there's all these ways. So I don't have to hear your whole conversation. And
God. I was at the airport the other day when I was, you know, stuck overnight in New York. And this guy is talking on his cell phone on speaker. Mm. And I mean, because he's on speaker, I guess he has the right to speak louder because he's talking on a speaker.
Right.
And I just thought to myself, will you just, you know, just hold the phone up to your thing and just have a conversation? Like, I was like, this the pet peeve, baby, pet peeve.
Admiral, may I ask you a question?
Spock, don't call me Admiral. You used to call me Jim. Don't you remember Jim?
And the deadpan look from Nimoy.
And he just goes, what's your question?
And I got to say, I mean, we've seen it in, you know, City on the Edge of Forever. We've seen it in so many places. I really think I'm putting a flag down right here and saying that Shatner and Nimoy could have been a great comedy duo in the classic Abbott and Costello, Laurel and Hardy. Like, I think they're that much fun together. At least maybe Hope and Bing Crosby. Maybe at that level.
That's well.
They are hilarious. Remember in Trouble with Tribbles when Barris, you have the authority to divert a starship, you know, with a false distress call. And then Niels Barris says, Mr. Barris is the head of all this stuff. And he goes on and on. And then Spock turns to Kirk and he goes, and that gives him the authority. And Kirk just goes, oh. They're hilarious together. But they were always, like, even when they first started doing those comic moments together, they were great at it because they were so perfect in these roles, whether it was drama or comedy.
Your use of language has altered since our arrival. It is currently laced with, shall I say, more colorful metaphors. Double dumbass on you, and so forth.
You mean the profanity?
Yes.
That's simply the way they talk here.
I just love this dialogue.
You'll find it in all the literature of the period.
For example?
Well, the collected works of Jacqueline Suzanne. The novels are Harold Robbins.
The Giants.
Harold Robbins. Oh, man.
And now we arrive at the Cetacean Institute in Sausalito, which, of course, is not in Sausalito. This is at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, which I highly recommend everyone visit. It is a fantastic aquarium if you're ever on the central coast of California.
And this is where we meet Dr. Jillian Taylor, played by Catherine Hicks. Catherine Hicks is an Emmy nominee for playing Marilyn Monroe in the 1981 TV movie Marilyn, The Untold Story. She was also in movies like Peggy Sue Got Married, Child's Play, the very first Child's Play, which still holds up really good. Also the movie She's Out of Control with Tony Danza. On TV, she was on the soap opera Ryan's Hope, and she was also in the TV series Seventh Heaven.
Yes.
So this is interesting. So originally, when Star Trek IV was written, the sort of guest of the movie was not going to be Catherine Hicks as Jillian Taylor.
Oh.
That character was supposed to be played by Eddie Murphy.
What?
Yes. Eddie Murphy. Eddie Murphy.
What?
He is a big Star Trek fan.
Oh, really?
Eddie Murphy had done a couple of big hits for Paramount Pictures, Trading Places and Beverly Hills Cop. Star Trek was also a Paramount property. Yeah. So they thought, and especially after Eddie Murphy expressed interest to be in a Star Trek movie, he was going to play a college professor who is very philosophical and teaches his students about whale song. So that's how he knows about whale song.
Wow.
But when the first draft of the script came to light, Eddie Murphy didn't really like the script. So he went off and made The Golden Child instead. Not that that was really a smart move.
Yeah.
But I, for one, am glad that Eddie Murphy did not do Star Trek IV, because I feel like it would have turned out like when Richard Pryor did Superman 3.
Mm,
yeah. You know what I mean? It would have been like an Eddie Murphy movie with guest starring the crew of the Enterprise. So I'm glad that did not happen.
I feel the same way. And I think like, because it's also, I mean, by the time Pryor does Superman 3, he is on the downward direction of his career.
Right.
This is peak Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and so like, I don't know that he's containable as a supporting player. I don't know how it could work.
I don't think Shatner would have stood for it at all, because he would have taken the spotlight away from Shatner.
Good point. And
then back and forth. Listen, I don't want to get blocked again by Mr. Shatner, but like, you know, we could get double blocked. He likes to be the center of attention in the scenes that he's in. And so he doesn't play ensemble characters for a reason. And so if it's his show like Star Trek, I don't think he would have liked being one-upped by Eddie. Because the thing is, Nimoy plays underneath Shatner, which is why the humor works in the back and forth.
Right.
He never tries to take the spotlight away from him. And Shatner cedes moments to Nimoy, which of course great actors do. They understand when they're on the level with somebody. And so you see that, but Eddie would have tried to own the scene at that time. And I don't know if Shatner would have rolled with that quite as strongly. You know?
I don't think, even though Nimoy is directing the movie, I don't think he would have really liked that either. But Catherine Hicks had to audition 4 times.
Oof.
And then William Shatner personally approved of Hicks after Nimoy brought her over to meet him, along with another actress who I don't know. Mm. Shatner gave the approval to Catherine Hicks, saying she was, quote, spunky.
Spunky.
She is spunky.
She is. I think she hits the perfect tone for what this is required for this movie. You know?
Agreed.
Yeah. In a lot of ways, like she, it almost, like in any other actress might be going too far with some of her emotional reactions in the, like about the whales and like, what the hell are you doing? And you know, all of that stuff. But there's such authenticity when she tones it down that you're like, okay, this is like when she's having the scene with Shatner in the dinner, which we'll get to, that's a much more relaxed back and forth. So she does, as you said, Steve, a really nice mix of the more emotional moments combined with the more relaxed and calmer moments that give her a much more fuller life in the film, which is why we like her so much by the end of the movie. And it's curious. She's the second Seventh Heaven series regular to be in a movie, right?
We
don't want to mention Mr. Collins, but he's in the movie. So, you know, it's an interesting situation.
That's separating the art from the artist.
So, and what we get as we're outside the aquarium and then as we're heading in is just, you know, a lot of exposition yeah. about whales that I think is entertaining, but they're not fish. They're warm-blooded. They're mammals. They are under threat. They don't attack people. Most of them don't have any teeth. And then we have this moment.
Unfortunately, their principal enemy is far, far more aggressive.
You mean man?
To put it mildly.
And I just want to point out, it's true in every class I've ever taught. It's true on every tour I've ever been on. There's always that one person who wants to show off and go like, I know stuff too. Let me be the smart one in the class or in the tour. And there's also usually one weirdo. That is the one person who's going to say some weird stuff that the tour guide's going to have to go like, I don't know how to deal with that. And one know-it-all. I just wanted to point that out. And we hear about all the ways that whales have been hunted.
100 years ago, using hand-thrown harpoons, man did plenty of damage. But that is nothing compared to what he has achieved in this century.
It occurred to me, just as you're saying all that, you know, even though I've seen the movie a million times, you know, and here it's a really special movie because you don't have a villain like Commander Crew. You don't have a villain like Khan or even V'ger. The villain here is man.
Yeah.
You know, man in a general sense. And, you know, like, you know, we don't even know if the probe is good or bad. I mean, I guess technically it's bad because it's like destroying the everything that comes across its path, but it's just trying to, you know, communicate. And that's something that we always saw in Star Trek as a key element to figuring stuff out. But the fact that you don't have a villain, and yet here's a film that even watching it today and watching the scene with the B-roll of the slaughter of the whales, it's still upsetting to watch. And Star Trek was always great when it held a mirror up to society. And I think this movie does that for 1986, and I think it does it for 2025, probably even more now. And all that exposition, Steve, that you're talking about, sure, it's definitely exposition, but it's done in a good way because it's an instructor, you know, talking to a tour group. And it's educational. I mean, like, this movie really has a lot going on, and it does it all perfectly.
What's interesting to me is that this is a political position. This is protecting the environment political position. And I think what's interesting is that there are some political things where immediately, particularly in our world today, it's going to polarize people. Yeah. If you say this, you're just like, aha, that's a conservative movie or that's a liberal movie and that's it. And I think what this movie does really well is that it humanizes the whales. It essentially anthropomorphizes them. And so it ceases to feel like this is a political pro-environment stance. This is a pro-George and Gracie stance. You know, we like them, you know?
Good point. Giving them names. And then even later, when the guy who comes out to speak to her is like, well, we don't even know if they have that intelligence. Having her kind of snap at him and walk away, and he's left in close-up for a little bit, it's just a showcasing of that attitude, that attitude and that mentality is not the right mentality when dealing with creatures
Correct.
Like this.
Yeah.
So that was really great. Yeah.
Yeah. I still get like pissed off at, you know, him for saying, oh, we don't even know if they're intelligent. It's like saying, oh, my dog or my cat or any animal,
right?
You know, but those humpback whales look so good. They really, really look amazing. And 95% of the time that you see the whales in the film, 95% of the time, the footage is animatronic. Yet it was convincing. It was so convincing that when the movie first came out in November of 1986, animal rights activists were in an uproar, thinking that real whales were used and had their, you know, personal space invaded in the process, and that was not the case.
To hunt a species to extinction is not logical.
Whoever said the human race was logical?
Which is exactly what Spock and his mom were talking about before.
Right.
You know, that's where, and there it was used as one of our charms because it was humans not being logical that saved Spock's life. And now it's humans not being logical that is killing the whales, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. The commonality, though, is that, right, it's like both selfish pursuits, one just selfishly in a good way and another selfishly in a bad way, you know, one to feed their... One to line their pockets and one to save their friend. You know?
And then, as you said, we're seeing the, I think, I agree with you, Scott. I think the animatronic whales and everything they did is totally convincing to me.
Yep.
They are mature humpbacks, weighing 45,000 pounds each. They wandered into San Francisco Bay as calves and were brought here. We call them George and Gracie.
And I find this, because there's this thing about our connection to history, which is that at the time that this movie came out,
yeah,
Oh God had just come out. We knew who George Burns was. And so there was enough people in the audience who knew that George and Gracie referred to George Burns and Gracie Allen to get a laugh. Yep. Today, there wouldn't be enough people that would know what that reference is, you know?
Yeah.
Crickets, buddy. There'd be crickets.
Yeah. And this was shot like at the tank, and it really looks exactly like the back of the Monterey Bay Aquarium, which doesn't have a big tank there, but this is not there. This, I believe, we're at Paramount, where they've built a replica of it to create this tank.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Very, very cool.
And then we're inside the aquarium looking at a screen where we're seeing the whales swimming in this giant underwater. Mm. And this, I believe, is shot at ILM. And the thing about it that I find interesting is like, well, we had a bunch of extras get off a bus in front of the actual Monterey Bay Aquarium. Right. Then we took them to a set. Then we took them to a tank built at Paramount. And then we were in front of another tank that's a screen that's at ILM. And I'm like, and what they had to do, if you got that extra gig, you were on call for a while and they flew you all over the state of California to continue to be an extra.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Good money those days. Good money those days. Yeah.
Well, for that one, definitely.
Insane, yeah.
And this is where we hear that they're going to have to say goodbye to them.
Despite all that they are teaching us, we have to return George and Gracie to the open sea.
Why is that?
Well, for one thing, we simply don't have enough money to keep feeding them 2 tons of shrimp per day.
How soon?
Soon.
And this is where you start to see the real emotion she feels towards these animals.
It's too bad, too, because they're really quite friendly, as you could see. I've grown quite attached to them.
I was going to save this observation for a scene later on in the film.
Yeah.
But seeing how passionate Jillian is about the whales and the way she has such a commanding presence, but she's really a lovely person.
Mm.
And thinking back to the female guest stars who had appeared, you know, whether it's, you know, B.B. Besh's Carol Marcus in Trek 2 or any one of the female guest stars in the original series. Who does Jillian closely remind you of?
Man, that's a great question.
All right. I know I'm going to take a big swing here on this, fellas. But the way this relationship kind of plays out, I wonder if Kirk, as he gets to know her better, if she reminds him of Edith Keeler a little bit.
Oh, wow.
I mean, there's more connections to, you know, City on the Edge of Forever than there is to any other episode of Star Trek. So I see that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I could say, I mean, certainly in the, you know, visionary, positive kind of thing.
Passionate, too.
Passionate.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's also Carol Marcus, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely Carol Marcus. But Carol Marcus was somebody he had a history with already.
Right.
In terms of meeting someone for the first time.
Yeah.
And let's just say, you know, City on the Edge of Forever played out a little differently. And Kirk was able to bring Edith back through the Guardian Forever into the 23rd century. Don't you see Edith Keeler being the kind of forward-thinking idealist that would, you know, go on a science ship and explore the galaxy like Jillian was at the end of this movie?
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, they never have that moment where it's like in just such a short period of time, they're able to organically establish that they are soulmates. Mm-hmm. But the chemistry between Catherine Hicks and William Shatner is so excellent, as we will continue to see in various scenes throughout the film.
Yeah.
And even up until the end, when there might be a moment where they cross the line, but don't, and the movie is all the better for it.
Yeah.
But it took me, you know, whatever, almost 40 years for me to see the connection between Jillian and Edith Keeler.
Yeah, I think that's a great comparison. No, that's a fantastic comparison, Scott. I could totally see that. And that may be, and you know, in another writer who's maybe more aware of canon, another screenwriter maybe adds a moment or two with him and Spock kind of